The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, then ransom our future and our children's, that's wrong. We must take America back as liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves. Pray God will bless some way out of this mess. We must take America back. Lord knows they'll try to silence our voices. They'll pretend to be patriots fighting for fairness for all, but they're not even fit to hold office. What they believe doesn't fit with freedom at all. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, and ransom our future and our children's, that's wrong. We must take America back as liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves. Pray God will bless some way out of this mess. We must take America back. Fight for freedom.
Yes. And the soul of the I'm on the air. John's not here today. Oh. Good morning or afternoon, America. I thought John was here and I was going to be his guest. And here I find out I'm going to host the show. Well, I got something interesting for you today. I want to know if anybody out there has ever heard of corporate personhood, because it's really interesting. As a corporate, with corporate personhood, you could be owned by a corporation that could be sold to another corporation. And it's my personal belief that the corporation known as the United States was sold in 1933, and everyone holding the status of corporate personhood may have been sold along with it. Because after all, the ownership rights to the corporate personhood would belong to the shareholders. Just like the desks, the chairs, the building, and everything else that went along with the sale of the corporation. I would like you to call in today and tell me what you think about this. Now, this was recently challenged here in California. It was in relation to corporate donations to political campaigns. And this was the ruling of the court. They said that corporations have the same status as people, and money is speech. This is what your court's telling us today. Does anybody out there like to make a comment? Phones aren't ringing yet, huh? Okay. Let me tell you about this case. It was in 1886. It was Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad Company. And that's when the Supreme Court decided that a private corporation is a person and entitled to the legal rights and protections of the Constitution affords to any other person. But the Constitution doesn't make any mention of corporations, so it appears that the court actually rewrote our Constitution in 1886. Okay, sounds like we're going to commercial. I hope you guys are going to be calling in when we come back.
Introducing the new Go Berkey Kit, the first of its kind portable water purification system for those on the go. The new Go Berkey system has an amazing output of about a gallon an hour. Each Go Berkey kit includes a 1-quart high-quality stainless steel system, complete with a black Berkey purification element, a generic sports bottle, and a nylon carrying case. The whole kit weighs a mere 2.25 pounds. With an expected element life of around 3,000 gallons, you can refill the Go Berkey system up to an incredible 12,000 times before needing to replace the element. The new Go Berkey kit is perfect for backpacking, hiking, emergency packs, bug-out bags, international travel, car emergency kits, or for your desk at home or at work. Get your Go Berkey kit today for only $139 by calling 800-724-2719. That's 800-724-2719. Go to republicbroadcasting.org. The online store, it's a featured product.
What really gets in the way of your goals and dreams? Time? Money? Education? Well, if it's all of the above, Ashworth College is for you. Ashworth can help you achieve your goals by letting you study at your own pace, online, anywhere, anytime. Your computer is your classroom. With programs as low as $39 a month, Ashworth College is one of the most affordable online schools out there. Just $39 a month. Plus, Ashworth offers over 100 nationally accredited college programs, such as criminal justice, healthcare, technology, and business. You could earn as much as $300,000 more than those without an associate's degree. No high school diploma? Well, Ashworth even offers high school completion programs. So call an Ashworth Career Advisor right now, toll free at 1-866-504-8173. That's 1-866-504-8173. Or go to ashworthtraining.com.
The Grainmaker Grain Mill. Handmade goodness since 1999. Handcrafted stainless steel and high-quality alloys. There has not been a finer grain mill made right here in the great state of Montana. Hand-operated, the grain mill does it all. Wheat, corn, peanut butter, rye, rice, coffee, beans, flaxseed, all grain types. Make your own gluten-free flour. Experience the satisfaction of providing wholesome, nutritious foods for your family without additives or preservatives. Each mill is handcrafted with manufacturer's lifetime warranty. To order your grain mill, call us at 1-800-724-2719 or go to our online store, republicbroadcasting.org. Take a look at why this grain mill will be passed down through generation.
Get ready for Real Talk Radio. You're listening to the National Intel Report with your host, John Stadtmiller.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ed Waller, also sitting in for John Stadtmiller. Humbled to be in this venerable time slot, speaking with you this afternoon. Joyce, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Ed. How are you?
I'm good, dear. I hope you're well.
I'm fine.
Well, the world continues to turn, but it seems to just get more and more bizarre out there, doesn't it?
Yeah, but you know what? It's starting to get interesting.
It is getting interesting. One of the things that has puzzled me the last week or so, since I actually went to a Tea Party meeting, and they were reading the Constitution. Can you imagine a bunch of people sitting around taking turns reading segments of the Constitution? And remember what Article 3, Section 2 says with respect to the courts? Specifically that if a state is a named party, plaintiff or defendant, the court of original jurisdiction is the Supreme Court?
Yes.
Well, where did Eric Holder, the chief law enforcement officer in the land, a bar card attorney with the largest set of attorneys in his back pocket probably in the world, where did he file suit against Arizona on their against their immigration law?
I don't think it was the Supreme Court.
No, it was the United States District Court out in Arizona. And the 20-some states who have sued the feds over Obamacare, what courts did they go into?
They went into the federal courts. They didn't go into the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So now here are a bunch of bar card attorneys sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution, and either they haven't read it, and therefore they just don't know what court to go into, or maybe, just maybe, they know exactly what they did. So were the states actually, the jure states, as you say, the pre-Civil War states, the plaintiffs in those cases? You know, it's a an axiom of law that a person, normally I would say man, but you've been talking about persons being citizens, yeah, that a person intends the consequences of his action. So obviously these astute and august legal entities must have known that what they were doing. And it seems to me they were putting out a billboard that says that Arizona wasn't sued in their constitutional, one of the jure several states capacities, was it?
Well, you know why, don't you?
I'd love to hear your explanation.
The feds don't think they're states anymore, so they don't treat them as if they are one.
Well,
they just treat them like they have the status of person, not the status of a de jure sovereign state.
But might there be a very good reason why they believe that?
Well, I got my ideas. Do you have any? Tell me yours first.
Well, because there are no more state electors. Everyone has been converted to a federal citizen, a United States citizen, and without a de jure elector, no one can be put into a body. I mean, one of the things I point to is that we have not, if you look in the Constitution, it says the office of the president is held in the president of the United States of America. When was the last time you heard anybody called president introduced as president of the United States of America? Well, I'll give you the short answer. Not since before, just before Roosevelt, since before the bankruptcy in 33-34.
Well,
so everything is proper. Everything is exactly as it should be given the current state of affairs. And it's obvious they're willing to tell us that, you know, there are no de jure states because there are no de jure citizens to occupy an office or even elect somebody to the proper office in the state.
That's right. No more electors. We're all voters.
Exactly. Now, all anyone has to do, of course, is rebut the presumption and go back to their original status and stop accepting benefits. Because as I have contended, it is under the, that pesky little thing called the Social Security contract that people get to be U.S. persons. Actually, they get to be federal personnel at 5 U.S.C. 552A. And they knew exactly what they were doing when they roped everybody into this. And when Roosevelt got his administrative state granted to him by the Supreme Court, May of 1935, they said, okay, you can have it, but it's only a rebuttable presumption. So what were the letter that you talked about people are putting in to fight this stuff?
Well, that's what is so astounding. A condition precedent. Basically, you just let government know you're not a United States citizen. You don't tell them, it's done like a negative averment. That's all you tell them. You don't tell them anything else. Let them figure out who you are. But you're going to love this, Ed. You're going to love
rebutted, this. Hold on a minute. You just rebutted the presumption, haven't you?
Exactly.
which is what the Supreme Court said you have the right to do.
That's right. And you can do the right with rebutting contracts. You can just, this is what, I got a phone call today from a researcher in Florida. A man said his condition precedent, that he was not a United States citizen. Then he said another condition precedent by open and notorious notice. And he told the world that he was never asked to sign the contract to use Federal Reserve notes, and he was not a party to that contract. Therefore, you couldn't hold him to any responsibilities attached to that contract, which is your federal tax obligation. Then he didn't pay his income tax. He had to go in, of course, he was charged with failure to file and all that stuff. He went into court, and he presented his condition precedents to the judge, and he filed a writ of prohibition claiming the judge had no jurisdiction over him because he wasn't a United States citizen. He presented his condition precedent, and he walked out of the courtroom, and he hasn't paid a dime in income tax since. Who would have thought that you could have done it? You could have done it like that.
Well, those people who look at the switch in time cases in 1933 would have known, because that's exactly what the Supreme Court said you were supposed to do.
That's right.
The Supreme Court said it's nothing more than a rebuttable presumption.
They're still looking for the remedy in the statutes.
Well, the problem is, and this is where the rubber meets the road, the remedy is in all the statutes. I mean, I have yet to read a federal law that is contrary to the Constitution. Every federal law that I've been able to find is properly limited, in terms of its scope.
I know, so, but it isn't interpreted like that. That's where the problem lies.
That's exactly where the problem is, because all these federal agencies with all their agents running around were never told that they were limited, although I believe a lot of them do know the difference. There's an FBI agent here that a number of us have talked to, and one of my friends challenged him. He said, you have no authority in the several states, and he said, the American people have accepted our presence.
That's
right. All he had to say about it. Well, that is basically the definition of de facto, isn't it?
Yes, but what he didn't tell you is we came into it on an individual basis, didn't have a clue what was going on, so how could we accept or reject it? But once you know, you have the right to leave on an individual basis, and that's what the people are beginning to do now. They're leaving one at a time, just like they originally switched from de jure state citizenship to de facto federal citizenship. So now they're just reversing the process, and they're gone. No political jurisdiction, and we were thinking about another way to challenge the court. You know, they won't ever hear a political question. I think if people start taking their actions in by asking a political question, they just might find that their cases are dismissed.
Well, courts can't hear political questions, but they're also being... you've got a problem. Pursuant to Rule 6 of the Brandeis Rule, court said they shall not rule upon the statute at the instance of one who is availed himself of its benefits. We call that ash wandering yourself. Okay? You can basically destroy your ability to have standing in a suit simply by not rebutting the presumption. Okay? One of the things I like to point out is in the Social Security Act of 1935, I tell people, look, if I apply for a new Social Security, I'm committing a felony. They go, oh, how can that be? I've had my Social Security card since I was just a little wee grasshopper. I say, well, it's very simple. You're holding federal property unlawfully because by Congress's own rulings and law, they never wrote the law where Social Security could be used within the several states. If you go back to the original Social Security Act of 1935, the term United States is defined as, the term United States, when used in the geographical sense, means the states, Alaska, Hawaii, and District of Columbia. of course, states, everybody goes, well, see, there you go. I'm from Kentucky, therefore it includes me. But wait a minute, let's go look at the definition of state. In the original 1935 Act, the term state, except when used in Section 531, includes Alaska, Hawaii, and the District of Columbia. Now, is your state listed there, Joyce?
No.
No. Okay. Congress, because it cannot legislate for the people or the internal affairs of the states, Carter v. Carter Coal Company from 1936, properly limited their legislation, as they've done with the Patriot Act, the Social Security Act, you know, anything you want. Any law that you want to jump up and down to be upset about doesn't apply within the several states. It's properly limited. You know, the problem is people have gone in and created legal relations with the United States through Social Security and possibly some other ways that has created the presumption that you want to be treated as a U.S. person. Now,
I got a better one for you. I think this proves that there definitely is not a country called the United States or the United States of America. I think it only exists on a map, but I don't think it exists in any political sense. The District of Columbia is a territory, right?
No. It's a federal possession.
What is the District of Columbia?
It's a federal possession. It's the seat of government. That's it.
Well, it was always defined as a federal territory, and that...
Well, it is a federal territory because...
Right?
It is a federal territory because it is included within that area that the feds have exclusive jurisdiction over.
Okay. Well, guess what?
Okay.
Guess
but
what?
A federal territory is not a form of political body.
That's right. But guess what? Title 4, 411, I believe. I don't have my documentation in front of me. Territories. They're no longer capitalized because there are no longer territories.
Well, they're all corporate. That's correct.
So doesn't that prove that the government is corporate? It can't be de jure. It must be a corporation since there's no longer. But the funny thing is, they list Guam and the Mariana Islands, but D.C. is no longer considered a territory. We don't have any territories. I want to know where did the territories go?
Well,
what kind of designation do they have today if they're not territories?
All right, keep in mind, and this is where it gets a little bit confusing for some people. The United States of America, well, first the states were created, right? You had 13 colonies. Then don't forget, we had that thing called the Articles of Confederation, which created a confederation of the several states. Okay, it had very limited powers. And interestingly enough, the Articles of Confederation were approved by the people of the several states. It was voted on and truly is a body corporate. Okay? Well, then, you know, basically 8 years later, 7 years later, they came up with the Constitution. Now, who ratified the Constitution? Well, interestingly enough, only delegates from the state, the people, never ratified the Constitution. And so, from the very beginning, the United States was a body politic. Do you know the definition between a body corporate and a body politic?
Why don't you explain it to them?
Okay. A body politic is composed of people. They are the people who comprise the body politic who come together in one union, also called a society, to be part of the body politic. Okay, a body corporate is anything which is a fiction. It is created by a corporate charter. It is created simply by an act or a charter. Okay, a body corporate can never be, a body politic can never be anything other than something comprised of the people. A body corporate can never be a body politic because it is not composed of the people. I ran into this with waste management entities all over the country. They went and created waste management entities And by statute, they call them body corporates and body politics. But they're not. I mean, I've actually, you know, called up the state legislatures and said, okay, where are the people? Well, what do you mean? Well, it can't be a body corporate, I mean, excuse me, a body politic, unless the people are a part of it. So, okay, so the United States of America, from the beginning, was a body corporate. It was not a body politic because the people were not party to it. Okay, then you have the United States, which is the sub-unit over which runs D.C. And remember, there's two types of power granted in the Constitution. There is plenary authority in Article 4, Section 3 over the 10-mile square and all needful forts and all that crap. And then there's the 17 limited enumerated powers. Well, interestingly, if you go back and study the 17 limited enumerated powers, they really have nothing to do with anything that the people would ever be involved in. It's about, negotiating treaties and international stuff and interstate commerce. And that's why the people were never intended to have a relationship with the federal United States for the first 100-some years. Basically through the Civil War and after, but it really got bad, obviously, after the bankruptcy when everybody literally signed into an agreement with the United States. So they had to, in order to find a way to have power over the people, they had to make them poor and make them hungry and get them to sign away their lack of a relationship with the Fed. And, but because of the rulings in, Shelby County versus Norton, the Supreme Court said in order for there to be de facto, there has to be de jure. The de jure has to be there. Now, the fact that there's not a single officer holding, you know, an office in the de jure government is, of course, a problem. And that's what we're running into. That's why the states don't even, or the feds don't sue in the right court, and the feds don't sue in the right court, because you're right. They don't recognize that the de jure even exists anymore. And why should they? What is there, maybe a couple hundred, a thousand of us out here who have walked away from the benefits and restored our status? And that's what people have to realize is they can exercise the protections granted under the Constitution pretty much any time they want, as long as they walk away from the benefits and then do your, you know, conditions preceding document, or we've got an exemption document, something that rebuts the presumption, and they stop acting like a benefit taker. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
I wonder, have we no callers yet, or is everybody just, or you?
I don't know.
I don't think my screen's being updated here.
Oh.
Still looking at the previous show's list of callers. Well, the board op will let us know if we have any callers.
Ed, maybe you can answer this question for me.
Okay.
Okay. 1933,
mm-hmm.
All the people were declared the enemy. My first assumption was, well, we must have been declared the enemy of the government. Who are they going to declare us the enemy of? And then a little more research showed that obviously it was the cabal of bankers, because to deal with the enemy, we had to have licenses. Since it was everything commercial, it had to come from the money, therefore it had to be the bankers. Is that correct? Is it the bankers that the people are the enemy of?
Well, I'd love to give even Roosevelt and Congress that much credit and say that, you know, that's what they were trying to do. Truth be told, what was going on was that the country was bankrupt. Okay, it had truly melted down. They were trying to find a legal mechanism to implement certain provisions that would pass muster. If you remember, when Roosevelt declared the bank emergency on March 6, 1933, the Supreme Court within 3 days declared that law unconstitutional. And so what happened was Congress then turned around and passed 12 U.S.C. 95B, which in essence gave the President and the Secretary of the Treasury authority to create law. In other words, they delegated to these, you know, the executive branch, part of the government, the ability to create law which would be binding. which had never been done before. There's no legal way for them to do that, but these were extraordinary times. They were doing some extraordinary things. We also know that, you know, Mendel House and a whole lot of other people had way too much power running around the halls of Congress. So the Trading with the Enemy Act from 1912, 1911, originally ratified?
No, the original one was under President Lincoln. He passed the first Trading with the Enemy Act, declared martial law rule under necessity. Roosevelt used exactly the same thing. He just rewrote it. But it says the same thing if you read them.
Yeah, well, okay. The first one I'm familiar with was from the First World War, 1912, 13, somewhere in that range.
Oh, you're talking about 1917, and then they amended in 1933.
Right. And whether or not, you know, that was intended. Again, though, okay, here's the important part of it. If you go back and shepherdize that law and look at it, you'll find that law only applied within where? The federal zone. Right where it should be. Because Congress cannot legislate for the internal affairs of the state. Okay? Now, how we get people to realize and how we get the feds to go back, put the genie back in the bottle, and realize that they're extremely limited with what they can do within the several states, is the problem, and that's where I think the people are going to have to start protecting one another. People are going to have to start creating assemblies and grand juries to defend their fellow citizens. I mean, the feds have declared war on the people. Of course, it's not Congress. Congress is still writing good law. You know, it's the agencies. And this is what Ralph Winterode, of course, is talking about, is he says Congress is even afraid of the agencies that now exist. Well, what do we do about that? What are free people to do? Put their foot down. Get out of the benefits and start. Well, there was a raid in Minnesota a couple days ago. I'm sure you heard about that one.
No, I missed that one.
They went after a bunch of people who are supposedly, you know, terrorists and supporting, giving money to, there are a bunch of anti-war protesters, basically. And the feds raided them and took all their stuff, and so 150 people showed up in one of the Minnesota cities to protest and said, no, you know, we're not going to put up with this. We need a whole lot more of that. We need the Fed saying, oh, man, these people are waking up and are upset, and we better not upset them anymore or bad things are going to happen. Look what happened in Bell, California. You know, they were committing a bunch of crimes, stealing from the people. So in one night, the entire city council for Bell, California was let go, gone, out of business. Okay, we have that power. We have the ability to do that anytime we want. But you can't have ash-wandered yourself and lost standing to complain by benefit. And you can't be afraid. You're going to live in fear. What have you got?
Well,
you're going to lose.
Those laws under the Constitution have no authority. So if you're going to claim the Constitution as your document for authority, then you can do it. How do we fire Congress?
Why do you need to fire Congress?
I think you just have to withdraw and refuse to obey. Congress is
I agree with that. What does that got to do? Congress is already writing laws that are properly limited. So why are you firing Congress?
I'm not firing
all
Congress.
All you have to do is put them...
I'm withdrawing from their jurisdiction. I'm not. I don't fit the requirements of the people they can legislate for.
Exactly. And by the way, they're not. Show me a law that isn't properly limited.
That's right. You have to volunteer to obey them.
Exactly. Now, the only thing you have to hold Congress's feet to the fire about is, once you've given them notice, and the federal agencies don't go away, and you've let them know that they haven't gone away, now Congress becomes culpable. They have, in fact, a recognizable duty to make sure that the president does what he's supposed to. And, of course, these are all federal agencies that are causing us problems, aren't they?
Yes.
They're agencies, which means they're under the executive branch. Well, if Congress doesn't properly limit the president, because the president actually only has one duty in the Constitution. What is it? To uphold the law. Make sure the laws are faithfully
executed. Make sure that it's the country's being run the way it's supposed to be.
Exactly. So if you tell Congress that the president isn't obeying that edict, that he's not making sure the laws are faithfully executed, then they become accessories after the fact. They become seditious. And now you can go after them as a body and an individual.
You left out one important thing Roosevelt did.
What's that?
He gave himself the authority to make law.
He didn't give himself. Congress gave him that.
No, he did. He gave himself the authority to make law. And then and then he redelegated his authority to make law to the agency heads that he appointed.
Okay,
you can't redelegate the authority to make law. Only Congress can make law.
Please cite for me where he gave himself authority.
He passed a law that says anything that this president once passed or any future president once passed is already passed. And the same thing for the Secretary of the Treasury.
That was 12 U.S.C. 95B, and Congress did that, not Roosevelt.
Well, Ed, you're going to make me work. I'm going to have to go pull up that document.
Okay.
Because it tells you the name of the law. But he also delegated the right to make law to the Secretary of the Treasury.
That was 12 U.S.C. 95B, passed by Congress, after the Emergency Banking Act was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court within 72 hours.
They totally ignored that ruling, didn't they? They went on with
No, they didn't. What happened was, after the Emergency Banking Act was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in an incredibly swift maneuver, Congress passed 12 U.S.C. 95B, which gave Roosevelt the power with the Secretary of the Treasury to make law.
Under the emergency?
That's authority they can't delegate.
And necessity. Whenever the public welfare may require. Exact same words used by President Lincoln.
Yep.
That's your law of necessity.
But even there, even if the president could make law, even if that power could be delegated, where would that law have effect?
Washington, D.C.
And the federal territories, correct.
And the territories.
So once again, we come all the way back. It's kind of like Abbott and Costello with who's on first. We come back to the real problem being that the federal agencies have not been properly instructed in the limits of their authority, right?
Exactly. And even if they were, the courts would broaden their authority because they do that.
Well, see, now there's where it gets real interesting. Because the courts are playing a game. The courts know about Rule 6 of the Brandeis Rule. They know you can ash-wander yourself and lose standing to complain and challenge the constitutionality of things. Okay, so when they're sitting there in front of you and they've got their laptop open and the NCIC report is there showing that you have a Social Security number, they have a right to teach you differently. The problem arises when you rebut the presumption and say, okay, I don't want the benefits, I don't want to be one of your slaves, leave me the heck alone, and they don't respect it. Now the judge has created a chosen action which is actionable against him in every way, shape, or form. And what I suggest happens is the people get together and do a presentment and investigate him. Because Congress is no longer, well, he's not even a judge, so, you know, Congress isn't even doing their responsibility of making sure that Article III courts were even created. The United States District Court is not an Article III court. It's been ruled on by the Supreme Court. So what are we supposed to do? Evidently, the people have to step up. When are we going to step up? Some of us have, by the way, and it is working, and your folks who are doing their condition proceeding document, like you said, in with some courts, in some cases, it's working, right?
Well, I'm also advising them of a method to challenge a malaprohibitor crime by not even going into a court. Because it's administrative, they have the right to have an administrative hearing, because it's no pro hoc rationalization if you go into the court and lose. They'll tell you you didn't exhaust all your administrative remedies, and that people don't even know what their other administrative remedies are. And what it is a hearing with the administrative, the head of the agency that you're being charged with the malo prohibit a crime with. And if you go in there and show him your condition precedent, he sees you moved out of the statutes, and there's no jurisdiction, therefore there can be no crime. So everything is dismissed. And they don't even go into a court to have it done.
Well, interestingly enough, you should bring that up. And can't believe we haven't had a break. I think we've blown through a couple of them here. Interestingly enough, out here in North Carolina, the courts, for any of us who go in and raise a little hassle, are taking traffic tickets, which are normally considered a criminal violation, and they're making them infractions. They're actually changing them on the court docket to infractions.
You'll have to tell me what that means. What is the penalty for an infraction?
Well, an infraction can still have what we would consider a, you know, a civil penalty, but an infraction is not a criminal offense and cannot be, you know, handed down as such.
Okay.
Here, normally, if you go to court on a traffic ticket, they're going to tell you that the potential fine is, you know, 90 days in jail and a $250 fine. Well, an infraction cannot have a jail term associated with it because it's not a criminal offense. It's a quasi-civil offense. And I've seen two in the last week of traffic cases here in North Carolina where they were originally docketed as criminal violations, you know, the way they normally do things. And as soon as the person showed up and made his challenges to authority and everything else, bada boom, bada bing, they became infractions. Which, of course, the courts have ruled that all traffic cases are civil. There's nothing criminal about them.
That's right. In fact, we don't have a criminal code, do we? A federal criminal code.
Well, it can't. The Supreme Court has ruled that there is no national police force. And if you look at Title 18, it is properly limited to within the federal zone.
That's right. Title 18 that everyone gets charged with.
Hmm?
They were never given authority for anything criminal. They have to reach into the states and use the state's criminal code
in order to charge you with
the federal crime, right?
They actually have a delegation of authority on four crimes in the Constitution. How many of them can you get, Joyce? I'm going to put you on the spot here, dear.
Treason, kidnapping, piracy, and what's it called when you reproduce the money? Oh, what's that called?
You're close. Kidnapping is not one of them.
Oh, is it
treason?
Treason,
piracy, tampering with the mails, and counterfeiting. That's it.
That's it, right. That's all they have jurisdiction over.
That's all they have jurisdiction over. That's all they can come and mess with you on. So every time the FBI gets involved and comes into the states, something else has to be going on. And, of course, what's going on is the presumption that you're a federal person.
You want me to tell you something interesting? When I saw it, I couldn't believe it.
What's that?
You heard publicly that they were charged with counterfeiting, but because it isn't real money, you know what they were charged with? Copyright infringement.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've never actually seen a docket where I can support that.
Well, so, it's not real money. Counterfeiting would mean if you made an imitation United States silver dollar or a quarter, and you know, they're coins. But you can't counterfeit private money. It falls under a copyright. It's not real money. So how can you counterfeit something that's not real to begin with?
I understand those arguments. Like I say, I've never seen an actual case docketed where they were charged with copyright violation. I've heard the rumors. But I'm really in a position in my life where I don't trust anything unless I can verify it.
Well, there hasn't been a case like that for, I guess, 30 years or more even. I think it was one case that they brought, and the ruling was they weren't counterfeiting because It was only a copyright violation because it wasn't real money. You can't charge somebody with counterfeiting some. Isn't that what counterfeiting is? Reproducing something that's real, but what you produce doesn't have the authority of the real thing. And if Federal Reserve notes are private, backed by nothing but the labor of the people, then they're really not. It's not a tangible thing. It's basically just something that has a copyright on it, just like they copyright their law books. There's no real law on them.
They may copyright their law books, but once again, the problem is the Supreme Court has ruled that they can't copyright it. That the laws of the nation are indeed accessible to the people and are uncopyrightable. So, you know, we get in this situation where obviously if they are copyrighting them, that means that they aren't the laws of the nation.
Exactly.
Because the Supreme Court has said they can't do that.
The law is supposed to belong to the people, but instead it belongs to their private corporation.
It does, and that's why that right there is another tip-off that we aren't dealing in a de jure lawful government, so people need to step back and assume their proper role holding office as one of we the people.
Well, I want to tell you, Ed, they are getting very worried. And I mean very, very worried because July of 2010, the Department of Justice, an agency with no lawful authority except their own, decided that they made a whole new list of everybody that's a terrorist now. And basically, every single constitutionalist in America can be charged with terrorism for wanting to live under their own constitution and live free. How do you make that a crime?
Well, obviously, they can't.
I'm waiting to see the first person that they arrest on that and see what goes on. That might cause
an
evolution in America.
Well, what needs to go on is the people need to come out in droves and start subpoenaing federal agents involved in such, you know, terrorism and call them on the carpet, as we have the right and the authority to do.
Well, doesn't every judge sit with a conflict of interest? Shouldn't he be recusing himself because there's a conflict of interest? How are you going to get a fair ruling from a judge that's working for the same system that's charging you with the crime?
Well, I don't think you should. I say the people themselves have to intervene. People themselves have to take the position that, look, everything that's done is done in the name of the people, right?
Well, but you know what? That brings up another interesting thing.
Well, okay, wait a minute. We got to finish where I was going first.
Go ahead.
Isn't everything that's done done in the name of the people? Well,
yes.
Of course it is.
Yes.
So that means we have the right to call back our authority at any time when the wrong thing is done.
That's right. Why don't we just send a gazillion letters and say we're the people and we don't think it's a crime? So
why do we have to send letters? Why don't we? The Second Amendment says, and I don't want to claim any rights under the federal constitution, but your state constitution will say the same thing. We have the right to assemble. Everyone thinks that an assembly is people getting out on the street corner and huffing and puffing and raising cane. That is not an assembly. An assembly is an august body of citizens who come together for their own welfare and to tell their government what to do. And so that's what people have to do. They have to come together and tell their government, nope, you're not getting away with this one. Cease and desist, or we will bring charges.
You know what Justice Story said, don't you, in regards to the Second Amendment? He said, people uprising in a rebellion is not insurrection if the intention is to restore lawful constitutional government.
Exactly. And so when they come after us as terrorists wanting to live under the Constitution, we have the duty and the authority to respond by doing a grand jury and investigating with a presentment and handing down charges against those people who are, you know, violating their own oaths of office, to uphold and defend that Constitution.
Well, here's an interesting thing I just learned. And after doing research for 35 or 40 years, I don't know how I ever missed it. There's no authority in the Constitution for Congress to take an oath. So they wrote one for themselves right after the Civil War.
Well, whoa, hold the phone. What do you mean there's no authority in the Constitution for Congress to take an oath?
Well, it says,
right in the Constitution, every person shall take the oath except for the president. He has a special oath.
But listen, they take an oath in private. It's not public. And this is why I brought up being declared the enemy. We supposedly lost all our rights and no standing in the courts as a declared enemy in 1933. Everyone in Congress is also the declared enemy. If they have no standing in the courts, how do they write the laws? That's one question. Second question is, they can remove that legal disability from themselves with a vote of two-thirds of the House of Congress and the Senate. Now, since they take the oath in private, how do we know they're not removing that legal liability from themselves, which means they have created a whole entire protected class, has no authority in the Constitution.
Their oath has to be on the record and discoverable.
Well, you know, they don't have public official bonds anymore. 1972.
I do know that. That went out in 1973.
Right. So,
Don't they have to have bonds? What should happen is the people should investigate this. Sit down with a grand jury or an assembly and investigate whether the removal of public bonds was in keeping with what the people want to have happen.
That's just it. Serving a corporation, they're not public officials. They're federal employees. That's what the people... In fact, do you know
But you're dealing with a symptom again, not the disease. Okay. The fact that it has gone corporate is the symptom. And we have to start dealing with the disease, which is that these people who claim to be holding an office need to put up or shut up and prove that they're holding the office.
Not only that, there's a federal law against impersonating a federal official. They could all be arrested for impersonating a federal official.
Absolutely. But who's going to do it if it's not the people who sit down and do presentment?
Well, anybody out there listening that lives in California, you check the Business and Corporation Code. We vote for judges in California, but they're not considered public officials. They're listed in the Corporation and Business Code. Now, if they're not public officials, what authority do they have to send anyone to jail? Anybody's got somebody in jail, you ought to challenge the authority of a judge who is not a public official to sentence them to jail. They're not a public official. It's like me sentencing somebody to jail. They have as much authority as I do, or you do, or anybody else does. None.
Well, all the people have to do was belly up to the bar and start taking their country back. I'm curious if anybody's hearing us, Joyce. It's about 7 minutes before the hour. We haven't had a break since the first one. And I don't hear much of anything going on, do you?
I don't hear anything going on. Is there anybody out there? Just call in so we know you're listening, please.
How about board operator? How about letting us know we're actually going out on the air? Normally those guys are listening pretty... Say what? We're there? Okay, what happened to our break? Okay, well, you guys may want to check on that. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. So, thank you. All right, we are having a conversation with the grand old United States of America, Joyce, and they're not even interrupting us for our profit center breaks. Now, does it get any better than that on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon?
Well, they must be fascinated with the conversation. They just want it to continue.
Evidently, we're just being so engaging here that they don't think we can be disturbed. We'll lose our train of thought. Wait a minute. Are they implying that we're senile?
No, I'm saying this is an interesting conversation. We're challenging everything, and you and I are actually proving our point just having this little chat on the phone with everybody in America listening.
That's the idea. We're trying to engage and enlighten and just challenge people to wake up and organize amongst yourselves in your communities and start asking questions. We've had very good luck here in North Carolina bringing agents to heel. I'm actually preparing a lawsuit that's going into the North Carolina Supreme Court over the issue of Social Security numbers and driver's licenses, IDs, and learner permits. My son turned 15. He went to get his learner's permit. They said, no, you can't have one unless you give a Social Security number. So I went to my...
Set a condition precedent for him. I did it in Pennsylvania years and years and years ago, and I refused to give him a Social Security number to get a driver's license. I had a condition precedent set, and when you want to deal with anything constitutional, you don't go into a court. You go to the head of the department or the agency of your state, because he's the only one that has any authority to do it. And I wrote him a letter telling him that I cannot be denied a God-given right for a privilege. They can't convert that into a crime. Therefore...
We went so far beyond that. We actually convened an assembly. I had 24 people get together. They wrote up, in essence, instructions to the state, because in Article 1, Section 12 of the North Carolina Constitution, it says the people have the right to assemble and instruct their representatives. So we get to tell them what to do. That's what the Constitution says. So served on the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, on the Speaker of the House, the President pro tempore of the Senate, and the Governor, were formal instructions from the people informing them that a requirement to have a Social Security number was a violation of the law, was a violation of due process and equal protection, and that they had 10 days to contact me and let me know how my son could get his learner's permit. Well, the 10 days expired about 3 weeks ago. They wouldn't even respond.
Well, there's no
law
requiring. There's no law requiring a Social Security number.
I agree with that.
So how can they hold you? How can they say you're violating the law if there is none? How
no,
can they hold you to do something with there's, the, when there's no law the, requiring it?
The
it's
assembly
an absurdity.
Itself. Hold on. The assembly told the state that they were violating federal law, equal protection. It was a power grab, and that they couldn't do that. Hey, how about that? I guess we got
here's
some commercials
music.
Back.
You feel better?
Yeah. Well, we'll take a break. Let everybody ponder on this a little bit, and come back with the National Intel Report. Your host, Joyce Annette.
Take America back. We must take America.